Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome to the very first episode of The Critic's new podcast, Blacks History Week. The former Prime Ministers, John Major, Tony Blair and Theresa May, have all criticised Boris Johnson's handling of the Internal Market Bill and the Withdrawal Agreement. But how common is it for ex-Prime Ministers to continue to play a prominent part in British politics after they have left Downing Street? And do American presidents mostly find it easier to resist the urge to influence political debate after their White House tenure expires? In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black, biographer of Robert Walpole and Pitt the Elder, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the ruling passion and which of the past masters have successfully influenced politics after their time in office elapsed.
Professor Jeremy Black, I suppose we should begin by distinguishing the difference between prime ministers who retire into private life and those who stay involved in frontline politics, particularly those who then use the upper chamber of parliament, the House of Lords, as a place to pursue their political ideals. We'll come to some more recent examples in a moment, but I wonder if we might start with the example of the mid-18th century Prime Minister William Pitt the Elder. What did he achieve as Prime Minister, and how did he go about trying to influence public life after he ceased to be Prime Minister?
Well, William Pitt the Elder essentially was a House of Commons man who forced himself into office. He wasn't really welcome to either George II or to the Duke of Newcastle, the key political figure. And having been Secretary of State during, or one of the two Secretaries of State during the Seven Years' War, that's the war 1756 to 63, in which Britain conquers Canada, becomes the great power, defeats the French, really transforms the situation in the Atlantic world. Pitt is a difficult colleague. Falls out with George III and indeed with his own ministerial colleagues, resigns in a huff in 1761 when he can't force them into war with Spain quickly enough, and then is a difficult character. Now, the point that what you're asking about is essentially prime ministers, or subsequently presidents, after they lose office and how they then behave themselves. I think we can start off with several points. Demographics is a key one. Most ministers, first ministers, presidents in the past became prime minister or president older and died younger than most of their counterparts today. So literally their period of, as it were, post-office politicking or non-politicking was shorter. That's point one. Second of all, ill health was an issue in the past, as it of course it is in the present. So if you combine people, sort of retiring closer to death, they might then spend their last period of time ill. I mean, you know, Neville Chamberlain's a good example in 1940 of cancer, for example. I don't think he would have led an opposition to Churchill. I mean, after all, he was still leader of the Conservative Party. I don't think he would have done. But he was also a dying man and, in fact, died later in 1940. And Churchill famously paid great tribute to him. So in the 18th century, the variable is both what we're talking about, health. So, for example, Sir Robert Walpole ceases to be Prime Minister in 1742, doesn't die till 1745, but has a pretty appalling health situation in 43-44. So although he doesn't like the King's First Minister, John Earl Carteret, he is not, you know, as it were, going to throw his weight around from the House of Lords. But the other major difference is this. The First Minister is the First Minister of the Crown. The King is more important. So if the King has, as it were, no longer favour for somebody who was their First Minister, then it is very difficult for that individual to play a major role in as far as many parliamentarians are concerned. Many parliamentarians were uneasy about the idea of opposing the royal will, and that does mean that former first ministers are often in a slightly difficult position from that point of view. Now, that wasn't going to stop William Pitt the Elder. William Pitt the Elder is opposed to George III's first minister, his favourite, if you want to use that term, John III, Earl of Bute. He regards the Peace of Paris of 1763 that ends the Seven Years' War, he regards it as a sellout peace, and he is extraordinarily difficult in some respects politically. But on the other hand, ironically, both George III, who's become king in 1760, and as I hope you are going to tell everybody, Graham, they ought to read my new biography shortly out, but anyway, whether they do or not, they can just listen. Both George III and William Pitt the Elder actually share, at the very basic level, a political idea. And this political idea is that government ought to be beyond party, that in a sense, they both have this image of the previous generation of politicians of being obsessed by party issues, but being particularly Whigs, and that what the king and what the minister should do is try and be somebody that brings together men of talent. I'm afraid it was a gender system in that period, but men of talent, whatever their political background. And that is why, ironically, Pitt becomes Prime Minister again in 1766. Now, he doesn't wish to be First Lord of the Treasury, which is just as well, because he's not a financial wizard by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, he's frequently in debt. But he is effectively the chief minister from 1766. And then, and you know, I mentioned this point about ill health. I mean, his mental health has always been a little precarious, but his physical health as well really sort of collapses to a great extent in 1767. He has a collapse, partly it's psychosomatic, and he goes into a period of rural seclusion from which he pops out. He's now the Earl of Chatham, and decries policy over America. But again, it's quite interesting here. Pitt takes the view that it is a mistake to fight the American colonists, but he also takes the view that it's a mistake of the American colonists to press for independence. So he has his own distinctive stance right to the right through, and indeed on the 7th of April 1778, whilst speaking and saying how he's against the idea of American independence, he collapses in the House of Lords. There's a famous painting of that in the National Portrait Gallery, and he dies a month later. Well, that is the most dramatic, I think you can fairly say, ex-prime minister of the 18th century. And I think in terms of, well, the drama of his collapse in the House of Lords, I think it's the most dramatic of any former prime minister. Very few other people have taken their integrity to the extent of dying for their opinions. Oh, that's horrible, but you know what I mean, Graham. So in the 19th century, you've got a different situation, because you've got the development of a much more formulated party politics, which means inevitably that if the other side is in, people such as Gladstone are in effect leaders of the opposition. So that's a very different status in which a former prime minister is allowed to have that position in order to decry the politics of the current administration. Now, the issue that tends to cause most interest, might be a phrase to use, is when you have somebody who is decrying the current policies and leadership of a political party which they had been the prime minister and leader of, and doing so in public. It's quite, I wouldn't say commonplace, but it was, you know, it happened that people would always do that sort of thing in private, right back, in fact, to the old core Whigs of the early 18th century. But doing it in public, I think, is an interesting perspective. And of course, that becomes more common in recent decades because you've got more former prime ministers whom are younger and who are still active. They've not, party politics gives them the opportunity, if they so wish, to take that role. Now, so that's a classic example, I suppose, was Tony Blair. Tony Blair ceased to be prime minister and made his opinions on Labour policy in the mid to late two teens very clear. He was, in effect, one of the more vocal critics of Jeremy Corbyn. Tony Blair would no doubt tell you that Mr. Corbyn had sort of distorted and thrown away a great tradition, and Corbyn would no doubt say the same thing about Tony Blair. But that was certainly a very different stance, shall we say, to what you might have expected in the age of, if you're looking at former Labour leaders. I mean, obviously, Wilson during the Callaghan years, Wilson was already unwell. But if you're looking at Callaghan during the early 80s, I mean, Callaghan was not a fan of Michael Foot. But nevertheless, his attitude was, public attitude was rather different to that of Tony Blair. But on the other hand, you might say that Jeremy Corbyn did was pretty spectacularly to change the nature of the Labour Party, seek to change the nature of the Labour Party. Again, another big difference is whether the person chooses to stay in Parliament. Both Blair and David Cameron left Parliament pretty quickly, but whilst remaining healthy and willing to make statements and publish memoirs, which in effect were, you know, self-justifications. Whereas, again, going back to Callaghan, Callaghan ceased to be prime minister in 1979. He's leader of the opposition to 1980, and he's then he remains a member of parliament till 1987, and he's leader of the House, father of the House, from 83 to 87. So he is still playing a role in politics and is seen around the place, goes to meetings of the parliamentary party, whereas obviously, shall we say, some prime ministers have never been, of both political parties, party leaders have never been terribly well grounded in the parliamentary party, and therefore and have had very little willingness to take that role in once they've given up the party leadership.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Jim Callaghan is a fascinating example, who's someone who stayed involved in the political process, but no longer took a frontline role, I think it's fair to say. And one might say similarly to Gordon Brown, who remained an MP for 5 years after he ceased to be Prime Minister. Something interesting with Gordon Brown and also with Tony Blair, which is different from previous generations, is the availability of international positions to take up. Gordon Brown was certainly interested in the role of becoming MD of the International Monetary Fund. David Cameron's government didn't really back him for it, and it ended up going to Christine Lagarde. Tony Blair has had any number of international opportunities, not least those he's created for himself: Tony Blair Associates, Tony Blair Institute, Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative. I could go on. And this is very different. I mean, politicians of prime ministers, former prime ministers of previous generations, didn't seem to quite maximise that global stage, at any rate before Margaret Thatcher.
Well, I think that's true, but the range of international institutions created after World War II was not really there prior to that, and in a sense, I mean, there were international opportunities within the empire, but they were not ones that usually went to a former prime minister. So, for example, you know, you could be a governor general somewhere or other, but that was not the sort of thing that a prime minister would seek to do. I mean, the other thing, there is a big difference between people in the House of Commons and people in the House of Lords, because members of the House of Lords don't really necessarily in the past. I mean, you know, Rosebery is a good example. He's prime minister in 1894 to 95. That's, and he was obviously, as you know, an extremely wealthy man. That is his last major significant role. He doesn't die till 1929. And actually, he goes on, you know, he goes on playing a, you know, a bit of a role in the in with the Liberal Party in the late 80s, early 90s. And there is talk of him sort of trying to be a political leader in, you know, 1902, for example. But, you know, he's still going on thereafter, and he doesn't have a stroke, which really does leave him paralyzed, till 1918. And it's very interesting that he is not a figure that is brought out of the woodwork to play a role in World War One. His son is killed in the war in 1917, but, you know, he's not brought out in, say, 1914, 15 or 16 as somebody, a former prime minister, to play a role, rather like, for example, you might think Arthur Balfour played roles in, you know, cabinet level in World War One. And if you're thinking of Arthur Balfour as a good example of an individual who is able to go from being prime minister, not very successfully, I think one can fairly say, to actually being a cabinet minister who, you know, plays roles which you might take the view that he's better suited to. I mean, people may have different views, but he's First Lord of the Admiralty from 1915 to 16. He's Foreign Secretary from 1916 to 1919. He's Lord President of the Council from 1919 to 22 and 25 to 29. I mean, that's quite a lot for a former Prime Minister. I mean, if you're looking at other examples, Alec Douglas Hume, of course, is Foreign Secretary under Edward Heath. Heath allegedly wanted a cabinet office under Margaret Thatcher, and she wasn't having that. And, I mean, he then famously sulked. I remember, actually, very funny, I mean, I remember going to a Conservative Party gathering in Newcastle. I used to live in Newcastle, and Mr. Heath came to address us. And he was, you know, sort of pretty unpleasant company at dinner, and pretty to everybody, doesn't matter what their politics were, and pretty unpleasant thereafter. And he then gave a totally boring speech. But what had happened, and I was sitting close enough to hear that, is he said to there was somebody there from the BBC with the camera crew. He said, "I will turn my head, and then you should start filming." And he took, and so he goes rabbiting on about nothing in particular in a sort of ponderous fashion. In fact, rabbiting is the wrong word. It's very ponderous, more like a sloth in, you know, in treacle. And then at one moment he decides he wants to make his attack on Mrs. Thatcher. So he turns, nods, he gives his 2 minutes of bile against Mrs. Thatcher, which dutifully appears that night on the news, and then he resumes his role as the sloth. But no, he was not he wasn't helpful. And I think one can take this a stage further. Given that there were a group of Conservative cabinet ministers whom felt clearly unhappy with Mrs. Thatcher, I don't think that Edward Heath's position helped them.
Yes, and I think whatever one's views of Thatcher and Heath, the temperament of Edward Heath would simply not have been suited to returning into any subsequent Prime Minister's cabinet. It's interesting the examples you give of Arthur Balfour and Alec Douglas-Hume. I mean, what they have in common is neither of them were particularly successful prime ministers. And I wonder if that in a way made it easier for them to then have subsequent roles in the cabinet of others, in that they weren't sitting on such extraordinary success that their reputation preceded them and would have made it difficult for their successor.
Yeah, but it's also their personalities. I once had to judge some debating competition at the Oxford Union, and there were three judges, myself, some MP, and Alec Douglas-Hume, who, you know, former Prime Minister. He was the calmest, most genteel, politest of men. He did tell me he was off going shooting next day near Lockerbie, and it was very funny because I obviously hadn't really got much of an idea of what he was talking about in the ins and outs of the shooting. But he was a really nice man, extraordinarily nice to the students and very pleasant to the other judges. I think he was just a very decent fellow. Balfour was a bit more fey, but I think also, I mean, you know, it was a, he'd lost general elections. He knew he was not the man that was going to lead the country in war. He didn't have that kind of illusion. He's not like David Lloyd George in 1940, who has this fantasy of himself as prime minister. And Balfour was very happy to be a cabinet minister. And I've read some of his correspondence. I did a book on World War One, and I've read some of his correspondence as a cabinet minister, so, you know, some of the correspondence that's handwritten that he writes himself. And he's sensible and interested, interesting, holding down, you know, clear roles, thinking about the strategic problem, as First Lord of the Admiralty, thinking about the problems posed by the Western Front, in a very impressive figure. Now, Lloyd George is very interesting. There's a piece by Tony Lentin. He did a collection of essays in which the longest essay is on Lloyd George and Lloyd George interests in 1940. And it has, you know, the book has a dramatic photo of, you know, the occasion when Lloyd George went to Berchtesgaden to meet Hitler. And Lloyd George in 1940, of course, thinks that he is the person. I mean, Lentin goes into this in some considerable detail. He thinks that he is the person that ought to be the man that deals with Hitler. He thinks that Churchill is a sort of dangerous radical, and that he himself had done better than Churchill, etc., etc., etc. And he actually sort of takes the view that Petain, who he knew, of course, was doing what was necessary for France, and that he, Lloyd George, could get a better deal for Britain, but that it was also necessary to deal with Hitler. And I think it's fair to say that that was probably the most unhelpful intervention of a former prime minister in British history. You may have different views, but I think that was probably the most unhelpful. And the only good thing was that Lloyd George, who tends to be eulogized by far too many historians who write about him, that Lloyd George was sufficiently marginal a character that beyond his own hubris, not very many people were interested in what he had to say in 1940. But that was what the role he thought of. And of course, what's interesting is that Hitler had found time. Now, Hitler met all sorts of weird and wonderful people. But Hitler had found time to meet Lloyd George at Berchtesgaden. And of course, for Hitler, Lloyd George was the sort of the war leader that had defeated Germany in 1918. And Lloyd George sort of traded on that to say that Hitler would respect him. I don't think Hitler respected anybody. But, you know, that was the attitude he took. So that's interesting. If one's looking back, we've jumped all over the place. If we're looking back at some of the other figures, I mean, I mentioned death. I mean, some of the greatest prime ministers went on till they either died or became very unwell. One's thinking, for example, of Lord Liverpool, who's prime minister from 1812 to 1827, and makes that very difficult transition, which is so hard, from being a wartime prime minister to a peacetime prime minister, and, you know, becomes almost a part of the British constitution. And, you know, Liverpool goes on till he has a stroke. I mean, I think he would probably, he has a strong, again, I've read some of his correspondence, he has a strong sense of public duty. I don't think that if Liverpool had been an ex-prime minister, he would have made too much of a trouble for his successors. In the case of Wellington, of course, he's prime minister from 1828 to 30, and then briefly in 34. He then goes on, he's foreign secretary 34 to 35, and minister without portfolio under the Peel administration from 41 to 46. But, you know, others may disagree, but as far as I'm concerned, I would argue that Wellington in that period is somebody who is, you know, he's got a sense of public duty. He's led the Conservatives, or the Tories, if you like, in the House of Lords. He in a sense, doesn't think of himself as somebody that should be prime minister, sees himself as a steadying influence. And I think that's a reasonable assessment of him. I think he's actually a pretty good former prime minister. And obviously he goes on having a role in public life until he dies. Some other people, I mean, if you're thinking of Melbourne, he's prime minister in 34 and then 35 to 41. He doesn't die till 48, so he's there during the Peel years, but I think it's fair to say that by that stage, he's not somebody who is interested in the in really pushing himself. And then he goes on and has a stroke. And, you know, after he's had a stroke, he sort of, you know, he writes to the Queen, explains what's happened, and doesn't, quite understandably, play a role. But had he not had a stroke, I don't think he would have been a tremendously difficult figure. So partly it's a question of the nature of the personality of these people. But again, you know, others may have different points of view. There are some very good biographies out there on some of these individuals, and they're well worth having you know, people having a thought about them.
Well, from heads of government to heads of state, and from one side of the Atlantic to another, is the role of the former president, the president of the United States, have those who've held that office behaved in different ways to prime ministers, or is it the same in the sense that it depends entirely on the personality and their health and lifespan after they've been in the White House?
Well, again, you're right on those things. The other thing is that the party structure is different in the United States. So a former president is not a head of a political party in the way that can be the case in Britain. And as a head of a political party in Britain, and either sitting in the Commons or the Lords, is playing an active, I mean, diurnal, daily role in politics. So in a sense, there is, you know, once you cease to be president, you're in a very different position. Now, some presidents have played a prominent role, or have wanted to play a prominent role. You can think of Teddy Roosevelt in the beginning of World War One, wanting America to come in on the British side, being very uneasy about the thrust of American politics. You can think of other presidents who've had views on foreign policy and expressed them, ranging from Hoover to Carter, of course, who, you know, was sort of quite an active negotiator, including in Korea, in his retirement. Some other presidents, though, have become president of to relatively advanced age, and in their retirement have chosen to, as it were, be ill, do little, enjoy themselves, play golf, whatever, And, you know, some of the presidents of the later 19th century were not people who in their later life, some of them not even when they were president, would you describe themselves as playing a major and distinguished role. I mean, if you loop back to the founding fathers who became presidents, as you know, and they've made a muse, I haven't... I wouldn't regard it as a source of, I wouldn't cite it as a source for politics, but you know, they've made a musical about this dissension, but the dissension between the Federalists and the so-called Democratic Republicans, and particular between Alexander Hamilton on the one hand and Thomas Jefferson on the other, is a factor. And I think it's fair to say that there is a level of potential instability in the United States in the late 1790s, early 1800s, in which the attitudes of both sitting presidents and ex-presidents are quite, and would-be president, are quite important. That's quite interesting. I notice at the present moment, you know how present-minded people are. They're all saying America's never been so divided as it is at the moment. Well, of course, that's just hogwash. And I mean, if you can think back, I mean, obviously, we're not talking just about slavery in the Civil War. But if you think about the presidential election, which produces Thomas Jefferson, there's a lot of sort of militia, sort of saber rattling and talk about fraudulent election, blah, blah, blah. And then that winds on towards, during the War of 1812, some of the Federalist states refused to allow the state militia to cross state lines to fight the evil Brits. And of course, at the Hartford Convention, some of them toy with the idea of seceding from the Union. So you've got all sorts of interesting characters. And although this chap is not a president, Aaron Burr, as a former vice president, is involved in discussions with the British about in the mid-1800s. I mean, I've discussed that in my book, Shaping of America. You know, the documents are very clear in the Foreign Office papers about what you or I would call treasonable discussions, let's just put it like that, about certainly the policy. He's interested, as is Wilkinson, the relevant military commander in that part of the world, in the idea that Louisiana might be the kernel of a new independent American state, which, what a surprise, is going to be run by them. And you know, I mean, there's a famous trial and all the rest of it. So former characters can behave in very interesting ways. And then, of course, you know, we can take this further, if you like, by looking at other states, and you can see that it is perfectly commonplace. I wouldn't like it to say it's normal, but perfectly commonplace for people that have held supreme office either as a equivalent of a president or the equivalent of a prime minister to sort of feel that their successors are so behaving so badly that something needs to be done. A man of destiny needs to come forward, and what a surprise, they're the man of destiny. And of course, another little interesting subset, it's a very small subset, are people that abdicated, let's say, Victor Amadeus II of Savoy-Piedmont, very successful king, long-lasting king. He abdicates in 1730 in favor of his son, Carlo Emanuel III, and then starts intriguing against him, and whereupon he gets arrested. And, you know, later Robert Browning writes an eminently forgettable play about the episode. So there are all sorts of people who think that those who succeed them are failing in their duty and something needs to be done about it. The principal constraint on it, in my view, is when you have an effective party system in which party representatives are operating not in terms of some faction in which their votes are almost as if owned, or at least part of some fealty system, and that helped us destabilize the politics of Japan for many years. You know, people who had been prime minister would stand down, but they'd still be in control of their faction, and they would then destabilize their successor. But if you have an idea that your prime obligation, if you are a member of parliament or the chamber or the Reichstag or whatever, or the Diet in Japan or Congress, is once you have chosen your leader or your leader has been chosen by the members, whatever system is followed, then therefore you owe them your support as long as they enjoy the confidence of the parliamentary party, then that actually helps to restrain former major figures who might see themselves as kings over the water.
And we have an example rather differently in Singapore, where Lee Kuan Yew, after he ceases to be prime minister, he then there's this role created from the minister mentor. So he's still around behind the scenes with huge authority and power, not least when his son becomes prime minister. But
well, these are patriarchal systems, and one of the other interesting questions to consider is the difference if you have women as opposed to men. And there you need to look at figures like Mrs. Gandhi, for example, and to consider what she would have, obviously she was assassinated, but what she might have done had she not been assassinated, because Congress had become a kind of family fiefdom, which, you know, what did that operate any differently? You've had Sonia Gandhi since. Did that operate any differently if there were female heads or male heads? You know, you can have different views on that. I myself don't think there's any particular difference in terms of running a patronage system between women and men. But obviously some other people might disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, just to tie up and return to the United States for a moment, I mean, one thinks of Jimmy Carter, who's had his foundation trying to foster peace in various parts of the world. But I'm struggling to think of former presidents who have really achieved extraordinarily impressive things after they cease to be president. Is that the case, or can you improve my memory?
I think that's a interesting, let me just have a think about this. Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, in some cases they were unwell. I mean, I think, you know, Reagan obviously, Johnson obviously, and it's not easy if you only live 2-3 years, because you've got to get over what's your sense of loss, maybe. You've got to find a new role, and then you're dying. So that doesn't really leave you much of a chance. And obviously you've had other people who've become very unwell in office, Wilson, for example, or in four cases, been assassinated. So that rather removes you. And other people, one of the Harrisons, you know, died in office. So, you know, you've not got all that many. I mean, I'm not sure how big a set sample you want. I mean, Clinton tried to be a figure after he ceased to be president, tried to be somebody of influence. I think he was a bit more of a party figure than Tony Blair. I don't think Clinton matched up to Carter in moral seriousness. I don't think most people would disagree with that one. George H.W. Bush, a man of considerable talent, enormous experience. I mean, you could say it's disappointing he didn't do more in retirement, because he did have the, you know, he was very well respected. But again, I think for the Americans, the difficulty is this, that if you are an American figure on the international stage, you lose a lot of your domestic constituency. The Americans are ambivalent, I think it's fair to say, about international bodies and organizations. And within the United States itself, there are only very limited roles that ex-presidents can play unless they wish to be seen as highly partisan.
Well, we must leave it there. But Professor Jeremy Black, as ever, thank you very much for putting things in perspective.
My pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.